Welcome back. We are officially into Sunday morning. And coming up next, Rich Herity is going to join us from Australia. We're going to discuss the latest research into DMT. And before we get to that, there's a story that we have over at Coast to Coast AM I want you to go and read, which is down in Bolivia, a trio of boys hoping to acquire superpowers let a black widow bite them. It was all inspired by the origin story of Spider-Man. They found themselves stricken with fevers, body pains, and tremors due to the powerful spider's poison, but they ended up recovering at a nearby hospital. It's an incredible story. Go and check it out right now over at coasttocoastam.com. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Coming up next, live from Australia, Rich Herity. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. And right now we are going to discuss some of the latest research in DMT with Rich Herity, who is based in Melbourne, Australia, and he has strong interest in film, new media, and the new wave of psychedelic science. He has written for a number of online and print publications over the last decade, while also acting as a film critic for several radio broadcasters and podcasts. He writes for New Atlas, examining the era-defining effects of new technology on culture and life in the 21st century. And I would like to welcome for the first time to Coast AM, Rich Herity. Rich, good evening or good morning, and technically you're time traveling because it is now tomorrow today in Australia. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning, good evening. I'm currently, I guess, in everyone's future on Sunday afternoon here in Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah, exactly. We just hit Sunday here in the United States. And, of course, we're in Los Angeles. Now, Rich, let's start here. Now, the Coast audience is very smart, and we're always looking forward into knowledge and technology. When it comes to DMT, it is something that is discussed more and more in pop culture here in the United States and around the world. And let's start with the definition. What is DMT?
Yeah, DMT is a psychedelic molecule that is the only psychedelic molecule that is endogenous to human bodies. So that means that it is the only psychedelic substance that's naturally produced within the human body, which has made it a pretty unique and weird and exciting substance for a lot of researchers. It was only really synthesized and discovered in the early part of the 20th century. And the unique thing about DMT is that it isn't, in its pure form, it isn't orally active. So you can't swallow DMT by itself and have it do anything to you.
Right.
Only is active if it's injected or smoked, which has led it to be a kind of quite mysterious substance. It's worth probably noting that ayahuasca, which is a kind of shamanic psychedelic potion that a lot of your listeners will be familiar with, ayahuasca is basically DMT, but DMT mixed with another compound that allows it to become orally active and slow acting. So an ayahuasca experience is essentially like a DMT experience, but slowed down and stretched out over kind of 6 to 8 hours. Whereas DMT in its pure form, if it's injected or smoked, it sits users in 60 seconds and transports them really, really dramatically somewhere else, and then returns them to normality in anywhere from kind of 10 to 30 minutes. So it's metabolized very, very quickly by the human body, which makes it kind of tricky to track down from a science perspective, because it appears and disappears in the body very quickly.
One of the interesting aspects about DMT and the experiences with it is that apparently it is opening the door to possibly another dimension, a parallel world, if you will. And it's something that physics and science has been moving forward to as well. Is there an opportunity here for hard science and DMT to prove the existence of a parallel world or an extra dimension that has been talked about going back, you know, thousands of years?
Well, the easy answer is possibly, but there is, like you said, something very unique and different about DMT compared to all other psychedelic substances, from psilocybin and magic mushrooms to LSD. The thing with DMT is that, as you mentioned, there is this weird phenomenon that gets over and over reported by users, where DMT seems to transport the user somewhere very in particular, and the experiences that these people report under the influence of DMT are an encounter with an entity that very, very surely not themselves. So the externalization of this entity is very, very, very solid and real to the user. And that's kind of different to this common thing with maybe LSD and psilocybin that you hear reported, where people dissolve and become like one with the universe, and this idea of kind of the self dissolving into everything else is very common with LSD and other psychedelic drugs, but that doesn't happen with DMT. DMT, the self doesn't dissolve. The self seems to be transported somewhere else, and in that somewhere else, there's a commonality of encounters with entities. And I think that's where it does kind of question the fringes of science in terms of how much of this is subjective and how much of this is objective, and really kind of blurs that line between the internal and the external when you're trying to understand what is real and what is a projection of someone's own self.
Yeah, that's right. And to have full transparency here to our audience, I have never experienced DMT myself, but I have interviewed many, many people that have experimented with DMT, and I've read so many different reports about the experiences. And the one thing, Rich, that I find consistent is the description between individuals of a very similar encounters with these entities. And the description of what they see is, if not identical, it's very close, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think that it's trying to understand what these commonalities are. It was kind of what I think spawned this new research, which came out from a team at Johns Hopkins University just a few weeks ago. And this research basically set out to try to get some kind of empirical data that took as many DMT experiences as I could possibly find and work out what are the commonalities here, what are people most frequently encountering, and what types of experiences are they encountering. And I think that's where this new research is really fascinating, because it busts some myths, but it raises some whole new ones as well.
Yeah, when you look at the percentages in this survey, and your article is excellent, and we recommend it. Everybody should go and read it in the New Atlas. But the percentages of experiences that where the interaction is not only independent, but as close to being identical as one can imagine. And this isn't coincidence, in that with a normal psychedelic trip, or maybe it doesn't matter what the chemical may be, everybody's experience tends to be completely different, and they're not having the same encounters. When we look at the research and the survey going in recently with Johns Hopkins University, the similarities are almost shocking, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's kind of extraordinary. Like, this is the biggest survey of DMT experiences ever completed and conducted. And so what these scientists did is that they initially had an online survey that was accessed by more than 10,000 people, and these thousands and thousands of people recounted different types of psychedelic experiences. And then what the Johns Hopkins team did was they whittled down those survey results to just hone in on DMT experiences that led to a specific entity experience. And that seems like a pretty narrow thing once you kind of remove subjects with prior psychoses and other variables that could kind of mess with your data. Even removing all those variables, the team still ended up with more than 2,500 experiences of people that took DMT and encountered entity. So from that massive pool of data, you kind of end up with some really fascinating unified themes and commonalities, but also some themes that aren't exactly with the common idea of DMT entity encounters, which have been kind of mythologized over several decades by some key kind of psychedelic writers and some key research. So there's some great work from Terence McKenna in the 90s, and he kind of describes these DMT entities as elves, the kind of machine elves, which has influenced a lot of people's experiences, I think. And a scientist by the name of Rick Strassman, who wrote a really iconic landmark book called DMT, the Spirit Molecule, he conducted 5 years' worth of experiments with DMT in the early 1990s. And his kind of experiences that he recounted with his volunteers were very alien-like, very probey, very, very similar to alien abduction experiences. And so we've got these kind of benchmarks that have been influencing people, but the Johns Hopkins study didn't really find a huge amount of people had exactly those experiences. So we can kind of dig into the data for a moment and see out of these 2,500 experiences that were accounted in the study, only about 14% described the entity they encountered as an elf. And 39% of these people described the entity as an elf, which is interesting and significant, but again, not a huge commonality. The most common descriptive label for the entity that the study could hone in on was simply a being, some kind of being. And that seems clear, but there's a huge variety of descriptive labels that the researchers came across. So, I mean, 6% of people describe the entity as a clown, 7% describe the entity as an animal spirit, and 8% describe the entity as a fairy. So there's a huge spectrum of, I guess, what people are framing this entity as, which gives the impression, not necessarily that there isn't an objective entity there, but maybe the way that people encounter this entity and the shape that they put on it could be different, because the big kind of universality that we can get are that this entity is real and outside the person. So 75% of people out of these 2,500 experiences were entirely sure that the entity existed outside of themselves in some kind of different dimension or reality, or even our physical reality, but didn't. So that's 75% of people that were sure this did not come from inside themselves, but this entity is an externalized being outside of themselves, which I think is really huge, because 72% of people out of these 2,500 experiences also said that the entity continued to exist after the encounter. So they were sure that this wasn't something that was concocted in their head by drugs. This was something that they came across, communicated with, and then withdrew from in like 30 minutes.
And Rich, what does that suggest to you? Does it suggest that this is reality? It's just reality in another dimension, but these entities are alive, that this isn't not only imagination, but something that isn't real at all?
It's hard to say. There's definitely something weird going on here. That weirdness could be anything from a kind of a commonality in our brain architecture. So, I mean, we all do ultimately have kind of similar neural architecture, and DMT does activate our brains in similar ways. So the experience of DMT is similar from person to person. The nature and the kind of the pictures and the imprints that we put on that experience might be unique to us and our kind of experiences. Whether or not we're traveling actually to an external dimensional reality, I just think that's going to be something that I think scientists are going to really grapple with, trying to find a way to understand whether or not we can empirically establish that. I think that's going to be a challenge for future scientists, and I think that it's fascinating that that's a challenge that is occurring right now in various scientific university institutions around the country. It's fascinating that real health scientists are sitting down and having these conversations to establish how to clarify these mysteries that maybe 10 or 20 years ago would have been extraordinarily strange and now real scientific practices.
There's another exciting aspect to all of this. We're going to be heading into a break here in a few minutes, so I want to get this question in. Is that it is naturally produced inside of our bodies. Do you think there was a time in our past where this access to these other dimensions or this other world with these entities happened just as easily as you and I talking right now?
Quite possibly. The mystery of why this substance is found in human bodies is, I think, kind of underpinning the most fascinating question behind all of DMT research. When it was kind of first found a few decades ago in blood and urine samples, and we discovered that the body does seem to produce DMT, just didn't understand why it does that, and we didn't understand where it does that. And I know that there are a lot of theories about where DMT is produced in human bodies, and we can kind of maybe chat later about the pineal gland theory, but I think that the reason why we produce it and what the function of it has on a human body is quite fascinating. I know that Rick Strassman, who was his research in the 90s, did hypothesize that it's some kind of mediation for death. So it's released into the body at the moment of death. And he kind of hypothesized that the possible function of that is to kind of help be a conduit for consciousness to another dimension. That is, I think, something that would be very challenging for scientists to prove. There is commonality between the DMT experience and near-death experiences, and has been in scientific research, particularly by Imperial College in London, that have found really fascinating comparisons between reported near-death experiences and the DMT experience. So it's not out of the realm of the possibility that the body does produce it for some reason, and that reason is that it is activated at death. Animal studies have shown that it is released at the point of death.
Right.
In other organisms, so that has been shown. Anything past that, and it's kind of a really fascinating unanswered question.
Yeah, and with near-death experiences, you know, with adrenaline and possibly the pineal gland being kicked in and DMT allowing these very consistent visions from people that have shared a near-death experience, and that kind of research can't be ignored. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Right now, live from Australia, Rich Herity. We're discussing DMT. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. And I know that you might have heard about this story earlier this week that went around on the net. You can check it out right now over at Coast to Coast AM, because a troop of monkeys, apparently in India, attacked a lab worker and made off with blood samples from COVID-19 patients. The very strange incident reportedly occurred at a medical college in the city of Meerut on Thursday, when a lab technician was walking outside of the facility and encountered the troublesome creatures. You can read everything over at Coast to Coast AM. RichHarity.com right now. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, live from Australia. Rich Harity is with us, and we are discussing the latest research into DMT. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are officially into Sunday morning here in Los Angeles. Our guest is Rich Harity, live from Australia. And yes, we are trying to clear up the audio, and I think that we have gotten it. And now, Rich, one of the things, and we're going to be going to open lines here at the top of the hour. I want everybody to get ready for that. But one of the consistent things here with DMT experiences is encountering a being, I'm using open quotes, or a guide. And that those that have this encounter are then going for advice or asking questions. What do we make of that? And is that the intention of these beings or guides, is to help?
Yeah, well, what is kind of interesting about the commonalities in these experiences are, first of all, the beings are mostly self-aware and intelligent. In fact, 96% of all the reports surveyed in this study reported the being as conscious and intelligent. And then second to that, the most common thing was benevolence. So most people took this as an incredibly positive experience and didn't feel like the beings were threatening. Only 11% of people registered the beings as malicious. So one of the big commonalities are a positivity in the encounter and the being not having negative intentions. So that's a commonality. In terms of the types of communication people were having with the beings, there's, again, a really broad section of types of encounters. So there is no singular commonality in terms of the beings trying to convey something that we can track from these thousands of experiences. What we can kind of most commonly see in the reports are really kind of idiosyncratic messages and messages about personal behaviors. So often the beings will suggest to people that they should change their life for a positive. Messages of love, tasks that help stop people's addictive personalities maybe are often recounted and suggested by the being. Very kind of safe, reassuring messages. So it is interesting that these messages from the entities are reasonably commonly positive. There's not a huge amount of negative threats coming from the beings. They were kind of very rarely reported. They were reported, though. I don't think it's worth discounting some of these negative experiences, but these negative experiences were in the minority of what are generally kind of positive messages.
When I go and look at the experiences that have been compiled over the years from individuals from all around the planet, this isn't, you know, neighbors or friends. These are people that don't know each other. And the absolute consistency of the environment that they're in and who they are encountering and what the intentions are. You read the experiences and they're almost duplicates, Rich. You know what I mean? It's almost frightening for me to think that everybody is having nearly the same. They must be going to a place that is the same for everybody. And then there's this other aspect, which is that more than half of the people reporting themselves as atheists or agnostic before a DMT experience don't come out of the DMT experience identifying themselves that way. What is going on there?
Yeah, this is one of the, I think, for me personally, I find this the most extraordinary and interesting kind of data point out of this study is, yeah, this idea that the experience is so profoundly real and transformative that it does change people's religious identification. It's important to note, and one of the researchers at Johns Hopkins, when I spoke to them, were really kind of cautious about noting this too, that the anti experience is not a conversion tool. So it's not a tool that makes people believe in God, especially a theistic God as we would know it.
Right.
It's not what these experiences are leading people on. What they're seeing is that atheists and, to a lesser extent, agnostics find it impossible to have this experience and leave it believing in nothing. The experience is seems to be so real that it transforms their attitude that there is nothing. And then so atheists, over half atheists entering the dental experience, leave it not identifying as an atheist before. That doesn't mean that they believe in God. That just means that general kind of, I believe in nothing, there is nothing outside of this kind of organic body, that kind of atheistic ideal is almost impossible to hold on to for a lot of people after the strength of this experience. And that in and of itself is a fascinating thing, and it's fascinating to the research in so far as such profound belief change can occur literally in half an hour, because that's all this experience takes. Like in the space of 30 minutes, someone can be administered something and it so profoundly transforms their fundamental perception of reality that they have permanent long-held beliefs just busted, which is quite amazing for a single experience to do that.
Well, and we know that in the world of hard science, physics, theoretical physics, and these rock star physicists out there, that they are overwhelmingly atheist or agnostic, and that is something that, which includes their fan base, right? It is, they don't want to go into the zone of spirituality or question what consciousness is. If they go and start to research DMT and maybe have a personal experience, do you think that we would see a profound change in the scientists and physicists of the world, where they're going to have to start speaking another language or mindset?
I think, like I said, I don't think the single experience would dramatically kind of turn someone into a believer per se, but I do think what this experience seems to do to a lot of people is give them a sense of humility. It makes people feel a little more humble and a little less sure of their beliefs. If you are 100% a hard atheist that is positive, there is absolutely nothing else in the universe, there's no level of spirituality or interdimensionality, what is just what is. If you believe that and you have this DMT experience, it seems like the DMT experience, it humbles those people and they leave not necessarily believing in something else, but a little less sure of what they think is true. And I think maybe people being a little less sure of what they think is true could be a good thing in the world at the moment. I think that, yeah, people maybe just need to be reminded that they don't know everything for 100% sure.
With all of the talk these days about DMT in popular culture, more and more people are aware of it. Is there a danger of this being used recreationally with people that don't understand it's not only the power behind it, but you really can't control what you are going to experience? This isn't about getting high. This is something else entirely, isn't it?
Entirely. And I think that concern is something that is present in a lot of modern psychedelic science. A lot of modern psychedelic science researchers that are looking into substances like MDMA and psilocybin and trying to turn them into therapeutic medicines, they are all very concerned about the implications of maybe recreational uses, enhancing recreational uses, because that is not at all anyone's intention here, to get a lot of people to kind of recreationally be taking these quite powerful mind-altering substances. DMT in particular is kind of interesting because it doesn't seem to have any recreational profile whatsoever. It is so disassociative and so transformative that there isn't really a case where someone is going to be recreationally smoking DMT at a party. Like, that just is an impossible experience. It's such a transportive and disassociative drug that there almost is no way that it could become a recreational problem. But it has been kind of rolled into all these other drugs that have been utilized recreationally and kind of added into that whole taboo of psychedelic recreational drugs like LSD and psilocybin and MDMA. But DMT, to me, has been very different. And it's not something that you will ever stumble across someone kind of having a huge fun time at a party with. It's not that drug at all.
And help me understand in the audience when we hear about the consumption of DMT, that the actual experience itself is 10 minutes or it's 15 minutes. And then after that, it is over. It has metabolized and you are done and you are back to normal. Is that accurate to say?
It is, and it's quite remarkable in that way. In the 1960s, it was kind of anecdotally referred to as the businessman's trip because it's a drug that doesn't kind of have this huge suspended profile like LSD or psilocybin. It's not the kind of 8, 12 hour, even longer commitment. It's literally something that you can do in your lunch break. And so anecdotally it became known as the businessman's trip because it literally takes hold within 60 seconds, peaks within 10 minutes. By 30 minutes, you are back in a very normal, balanced mental state. You are kind of exactly how you were before the experience, except you might be a bit psychologically shaken or have your kind of beliefs rejigged. But in terms of the entire experience, it's a compound that's metabolized so quickly by the human body that it is just in and out in 30 and 40 minutes, which is why there's this secondary interest in the research side of it, because as we are moving towards the medical legalization of substances like MDMA and psilocybin, there's this fascinating potential for the short-acting psychedelic to be a kind of very useful drug in therapeutic context. I mean, psilocybin, which is moving very, very rapidly through the medical phase clinical trial process and looking really promising as a therapeutic treatment for depression, that's still a long kind of 6 to 8 hour experience that involves a lot of resources, you know, a lot of doctors, and it's a whole day in a clinic. And that's an expansive and challenging thing for medicine to incorporate. But if they can kind of work out a way that they can get similar effects from DMT, they could essentially turn these like 8 hour treatment sessions into 60 minute treatment sessions with the appropriate before and after therapy. But it's a kind of fascinating potential as a medicine that would add an extra kind of tool in the arsenal of these psychedelic clinics that they're already prescribing legally MDMA and psilocybin to have a short acting psychedelic as well. Is incredibly fascinating and potentially useful medicine.
Is it, and we're about to wrap up here, but one important question. This 10-minute, this 15-minute experience, is it completely recalled? Is it like watching a video? Is it right in front of you and the memory is crystal clear?
The recall is not crystal clear, I would say, but the recall kind of is reasonably strong. Like, that data is actually in the new study. So they did kind of track and survey people's clarity of memories of experiences and things like that. And 60% of people reported very, very clear memories of the experience. And they suggested that at the time of encounter, it was incredibly, incredibly similar to normal everyday waking consciousness. But
right.
After the encounter, you still had 63% of subjects recall that experience in the same way they would recall a normal waking consciousness event, which is quite a huge amount of people having the ability to think back to that event and process it in the way that they process something that happened to you yesterday.
So
that's the kind of fascinating thing. It's got a very tangible memory to it.
What is next, Rich, with the research? What do you think is going to end up happening over the next year?
I'm not sure. I know that the Johns Hopkins teams have shifted a little bit to start looking at ayahuasca, because ayahuasca, as I mentioned, is essentially a distended DMT experience. So they're kind of trying to understand, I think, a bit more about what is the commonalities in these experiences. The DMT research, and for the time being, will still remain on the fringes of psychedelic science in a kind of mainstream perspective, because it's just so difficult to grapple with and so difficult to integrate into general scientific processes. However, as MDMA and psilocybin quickly move to FDA-approved medicines, there will be a necessity to understand these questions about what DMT is doing, how it works, and I think that there's going to be some fascinating studies coming out over the next 5 to 10 years with some really interesting neurochemical studies, putting people through different brain imaging to see what is going on when they have DMT. And really kind of, it's a key to understanding how waking consciousness works, I think, by really looking at people's brains, finding out how this drug affects it and what subjectively people are experiencing. There's some really interesting potential future research in imaging the chemistry of what's going on while someone's having this experience.
Is it easier? I've got 30 seconds left, Rich. Is it easier for researchers to bring this subject up when looking for funding when a university like Johns Hopkins is now on board? Is it now more accepted?
100%. It's really kind of the whole area of research in psychedelic science has moved from the shadows of academia into the mainstream at an incredible pace. Like, I would never have thought 10, 15 years ago that we would be where we are now, this close to having psilocybin and MDMA as FDA-approved medicines, and having serious universities publish in serious journals studies that are essentially about taking a drug and how that drug makes you encounter entities in other dimensions. That's really incredible that this has even reached the mainstream level and the level that it has so rapidly. And I think it's a really fantastic advance. It was really difficult to do this research even 10 or 15 years ago.
I agree with you, Rich. I agree with you. We're going to take a quick break. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be back after this short break. Stay with us.